Part 4 of Vampires in the Lemon Grove by Karen Russell. The movie's title is already scrolling across the black screen. Something clandestine is happening in the corn. McGreb snorts. That's a pretty lousy name for a horror movie. It sounds like a student film. Here's your ticket, I say. I didn't make the title up. It's a vampire movie set in the Dust Bowl. McGreb expects a comedy, but the Dracula actor fills me with the sadness of an old photo album. An Okie has unwittingly fallen in love with a monster, who she's mistaken for a rich European creditor eager to pay off the mortgage on her family's farm. That Okie, says McGreb, is an idiot. I turn my head miserably, and there's Fila, sitting two rows in front of us with a greasy young man, Benny Alberte. Her white neck is bent to the left, Benny's lips affixed to it as if she's passively sipping a soda. Poor thing, McGreb whispers, indicating the pigtailed actress. She thinks he's going to save her. Dracula shows his fangs, and the Okie flees through a cornfield. Corn stalks smack her in the face. Help! She screams to a sky full of crows. He's not actually from Europe. There is no music, only the girl's breath and the flop, flop, flop of the off-screen fan blades. Dracula's mouth hangs wide as a sewer grate. His cape is curiously still. The movie picture is frozen. The flopping is emanating from the projection booth, now rises to a grinding roar, followed by the lyrical Italian cussing and silence, and finally a title sigh. McGreb shifts in her seat. Let's wait, I say, seized with empathy for those two still figures on the screen, mutely pleading for repair. They'll fix it. People begin to file out of the theater, first in twos and threes and then in droves. I'm tired, Clyde. Don't you want to know what happens? My voice is more frantic than I intend. I already know what happens. Don't you leave now, McGreb. I'm telling you, they're going to fix it. If you leave now, that's it for us. I'll never... Her voice is beautiful, like gravel underfoot. I'm going to the caves. I'm alone in the theater. When I turn to exit, the picture is still frozen, the Okie's blue dress floating out windless over windless corn. Dracula's mouth a hole in his white grease paint. Outside, I see Fila standing in a clot of her friends lit by the marquee. These kids wear too much makeup and clothes that move like colored oils. They all look rained on. I scowl at them, and they scowl back, and then Fila crosses to me. Hey, you, she says, grinning breathless, so very close to my face. Are you stalking somebody? My throat tightens. Guys, her eyes gleam. Guys, come over and meet the vampire. But the kids are gone. Well, some friends, she says, then winks, leaving me alone, defenseless. You want the old vampire to bite you, eh? I hiss. You want a story for your friends? Fila laughs. Her horror is a round, genuine thing, bouncing in both her black eyes. She smells like hard water and glycerin. The hum of her young life all around me makes it difficult to think. A bat filters my thoughts, opens its trembling lampshade wings. McGreb. She wants to hear. She'll want to hear about this. How ridiculous at my age to find myself down this alley with a young girl. Fila powdering her neck, doing her hair up with a little temptress pins, yanking me behind the dumpster. Can you imagine? McGreb will laugh. A teenager goading you to attack her. You're still a menace, Clyde. I stare vacantly at a pale mole above the girl's collarbone. McGreb, I think again, and I smile, and the smile feels like a muzzle stretched taut against my teeth. It seems my hand has tightened on the girl's wrist, and I realize with surprise, as if from a great distance, that she is twisting away. Hey, no, come on now, what are you... The girl's head lolls against my shoulder like a sleepy child's, then swings forward in a ragdoll circle. The starlight is white mercury compared to her blotted out eyes. There's a dark stain on my periwinkle shirt, and one suspender has snapped. I sit Fila's body against the alley wall, watch it dim and stiffen. Spidery graffiti weaves over the brick behind her, and I scan for some answers contained there. Giovanna e Fabiano. Vaffanculo, vaffanculo. A scabby furred creature, our only witness, arches its orange back against the dumpster. If not for the lock, I would ease the girl inside. I would climb in with her and let the bread stench fill my nostrils. Let the flies crawl into the red corners of my eyes. I am a monster again. I ransack Fila's pockets and find the key to the funicular office, careful not to look at her face. Then I'm walking, running for the lemon grove. I jimmy my way into the control room and turn the silver key, relieved to hear the engine roar to life. Locked, locked. Every funicular car is locked, but then I find one with thick tape and X's over a busted door. I dash after it and I pull myself onto the cushion quickly because the cars are already moving. Even now, after what I've done, I am still unable to fly, still imprisoned in my wretched Nona's body, reduced to using the mortal's machinery to carry me up to find my wife. The box jounces and trembles. The chain pulls me into the heavens, link by link. My lips are soon chapped. I stare through the crack in the glass window. The box swings wildly in the wind. The sky is a deep blue vacuum. I can still smell the girl in the folds of my clothes. The cave system at the top of the cliffs is vaster than I expected, and with their grandfather faces tucked away, the bats are anonymous as stones. I walk beneath a chandelier of furry bodies, heartbeats wrapped in wings the color of rose petals or corn silk. Breath ripples through each of them, a tiny life in its translucent envelope. Maghreb! Is she up here? Has she left me? I will never find another vampire. I double back to the moonlit entrance that leads to the open air of the cliffs, the funicular cars. When I find Maghreb, I beg her to tell me what she dreams up here. I'll tell her my waking dreams in the lemon grove, the mortal men and women floating serenely by in balloons freighted with the ballast of their deaths. Millions of balloons ride over a wide ocean, lives darkening the sky. Death is a dense powder cinched inside tiny sandbags. And in the dream, I am given to understand that instead of a sandbag, I have Maghreb. I make the bats descend in the cable car with no wings to spread. Knocked around by the wind with a force that feels personal, I struggle to hold the door shut and look for the green speck of our grove. The block box is plunging now far too quickly. It swings wide, and the igneous surface of the mountain fills the left window. The tufa shines like water, like a black, heated, bubbling river. For a dizzying instant, I expect the rock to seep through the glass. Each swing takes me higher than the last, a grinding pendulum that approaches, a full revolution around the cable. I'm on my hands and knees on the car floor, seasick in the high air, pressing my face against the floor grate. I can see stars or boats burning there, and also a ribbon of white, a widening fissure. Air gushes through the cracks in the glass box. With a lurch of surprise, I realize that I could die. What does Maghreb see if she is watching? Is she waking from a nightmare to see the line snap, the glass box plummet? From her inverted vantage point, dangling from the roof of the cave, does the car seem to be sucked upward, rushing not toward the sea, but into another sort of sky, to a black mouth opened and foaming with stars? I like to picture my wife like this. Maghreb shuts her thin eyelids tighter. She digs her claws into the rock. Little clouds of dust plume around her toes as she swings upside down. She feels something growing inside her, a dreadful suspicion. It is solid, this new thing. It is the opposite of hunger. She's emerging from a dream of distant thunder, rumbling and loose. Something has happened tonight that she thought impossible. In the morning, she will want to tell about it.